very real danger. People's lives can be and have been lost because of it. I think of the people in the Twin Towers. I'm sure a lot of them were very good people, hardworking people. And what happened to them? A lot of them, most of them, lost their lives. And so this business about getting informed and questioning what's going on, I think, is absolutely crucial. We need to share as much information as possible. American Free Press, that he was talking about, I think is a good source. I think you ought to tell everyone you know about Radio Liberty. Dr. Monteith's been interviewing people for decades here, and it's growing all the time, and it's radioliberty.com. Go to that on the website. Tell your friends about it. Tell your relatives. They can download it on the Internet. So the best thing we can do at this point in time is just simply keep sharing information. They go on to, this fellow talks about the necessity of speaking out. We have to speak out now on behalf of the community, on behalf of every, and it goes on and on. See, we're running towards the end of our show here. This has been Tom Clooney. Keep on talking, keep on sharing, and I'll see you next Monday at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Please have that thing set up so that arrow goes right to that zero.
Yeah.
Oh. We have to adjust the collar those times. That's different.
You want this to go here?
Yeah, well, anyway, just if you put that on yours to zero, and then the others you're going to have to adjust, you know, because sometimes the collars will be louder or more quiet. Okay, thanks. Sounds like a good program. Bye-bye. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us this evening two guests, one Ted, the other Kathleen Twightmeyer, and we're going to be talking about their experience with alien abductions. And I think you'll find it quite fascinating. But before we got to our special guest this evening, I was asked by one of our listeners to comment on what happened at the conspiracy conference that I attended a couple of weeks ago, and so many of our listeners were praying for us, and I'd asked specifically for your prayers, and this one very faithful listener said, you know, we were praying and doing a great deal of praying, and I'd just like to know what happened. You've never commented. Well, of course, you know, the question is, how do you know what happened? And then I begin thinking about it. Well, I go to a lot of conferences, and certainly I hate to put the Lord's response in a monetary fashion, but I have never been to a conference where I've had, maybe one or two conferences where I've had half as much of a financial response. This was almost twice what we've ever had as a response at any meeting I've ever attended before. Now, Is that coincidence? I don't think so. I believe that it was an amazing, amazing experience. We had an opportunity to talk to many, many people from the middle, from the New Age, from the occult, and hopefully just bring out a Christian testimony before them so they understand that Christians certainly are have very definite beliefs, and that what's going on in the world, which everybody is concerned about, the New Agers, the liberals are concerned about it. But of course, our stress, as you know, is to put everything that's happening into the spiritual into a spiritual framework so people can understand the spiritual nature of the battle we're engaged in. I hope and pray that I had the opportunity to honor the Lord and to speak for him and to perhaps bring some people to at least to an interest, an increasing interest in Jesus Christ. And I will tell you, I appreciate so much your prayers, but the most amazing thing was the response we had from the people there. And there were people there with booths, and they had tarot cards, they had crystals, they had, you know, everything imaginable. And I would say that we had, by far, that booth that we had, had far more action than any of the others. And of course, we had the opportunity to present as proclaiming Christians, you know, the word of Jesus Christ. In fact, in my presentation, I'm ended with simply asking that eternal question: if you were to die tomorrow, where would you spend eternity? And if you were to stand before the gates of heaven and be asked, why should you be admitted? What would your answer be? And your answer, of course, should be, because Christ died for my sins. Well, you know, that's the report. I believe that God is with us, and I want to thank everybody out there in the listening audience for their prayers that saw us through what I think could have been a very, very difficult situation if we'd had to rely entirely on our own capabilities, which are sometimes, I think, very limited. So with that said, let's get to our special guest tonight, Ted and Kathleen. Ted, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, fine. Can you speak up just a little?
Can you hear me a little better that way?
All right, you're going to have to speak a little loud. Are you on a regular telephone?
Yes.
All right, fine. We're going to have to speak up fairly loud so our listeners can hear you. All right, fine. Well, is Kathleen going to call in on another line or what?
She's also here.
Oh, she isn't on the same line, is she?
Well, yeah, that's what we had to do here.
Does she have a separate line that we could call her on? Because she may be draining the power off your telephone.
Well, let her speak. And
well, why don't we talk to you to begin? Who should we talk to first, you or Kathleen?
Well, would you like to speak?
You can go ahead.
All right. Well, why don't you go ahead? The thing is, maybe if she could just sort of listen to what you have to say for the time being, if maybe she could hang up her phone so we would have one good line there.
Oh, here, I can do that. Hang on a second.
All right. Oh, that's ever so much better. All right, fine. Why don't you just tell us your experience? And, you know, this is sort of something that doesn't happen to most people, although there's certainly a significant number of people in our society that have had these experiences. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Well, what happened is, apparently what happens with abductions, people either have conscious memory of it or they don't have one. And often, sometimes, it does tend to surface later on. Now, her situation was different than mine, in that she has a complete conscious memory of everything that happened, and she goes on to unfold what happened to her. We had physical proof that these things happened.
All right, so, well, what did happen? Let's talk about your experience, and then we can talk about Kathleen's experience. What happened to you? How did it all come about? Were you a Christian when this happened?
Yes, we've both been Christians for pretty much all our lives, actually. And I began to realize what happened to me, mainly when I began to get, how shall we call it, bursts of...
like flashback?
Yeah, like a flashback.
All right, fine. And so, when do you think this happened, and what do you think happened?
Well, I had first, some years ago, you have to be close to 4 years ago. It was the first time it happened to me. I had woken up one morning with an itch on my leg, and I scratched it, and it began to bleed, and there was an indentation there. Well, I noted it happened, didn't think too much of it, but then I noticed on my left arm, around the back of my arm, I felt three bumps, and they were perfectly symmetrical, very much like a small puncture, you know, with scab over, and then I kind of knew something was happening there, and things were fairly quiet until this past year. Now, with her, she had been diagnosed with MS, and, well, they had suspected, let me put it this way, as you know, MS takes a long time to get a firm diagnosis, right?
Right.
And, so they had suspected this for a few years now that she was getting it. And in just 6 months, can I say this? Okay. Here's my permission. I mean, I have her permission, excuse me. In 6 months, she went from, like, two lesions in the MRI to 14.
All right, so this is very, very rapidly advancing, MS.
Yes, it was rapidly advancing, and it didn't start until the abductions began. And as she describes what happened to her and the tests they were doing and things like that.
Now, the test that they, you mean did she see who was involved?
Yeah, she certainly did. And the most curious thing about it, if I may steal just a little thunder from you, is that there were three military officers present.
There were three military officers, okay.
Yes. And the Greys were doing the work.
All right.
Now, one of the things I have learned about the Greys, because I was a defense contractor for more than 20 years, and I've gotten to know lots of different people that have been involved in some very high-level things, and they've been disturbed at some of the things they've seen.
And, of course, we know that there's been a conscious cover-up by the government of what happened at Roswell. But the question is, why were they covering it up, and what were they covering up? So you then, as a defense contractor, were seeing things. But what sort of things were you seeing, certainly as an outsider, just being associated with the military? What sort of things were being covered up from the American people?
Well, the thing about the Greys is this: they're what you might call an organic android. They're not as autonomous as people think they are. They're a soulless being. They have no emotions, and they just basically do what they're told to do.
Well, now, how do you know that? In other words, from what you've been told from others, or from what your wife saw, or from your personal experience?
Well, just from my own experience and from knowledge I've, let's just say, obtained. And these beings are like worker bees, you know. They have sort of a commune-type mentality, and they just buzz around and do as quickly as possible whatever it is they're supposed to be doing. So they're the perfect little thing to use to do unsavory little things to people, let's put it that way.
All right. What did you learn as a military contractor from other people in the Defense Department or military people you came in contact with? You alluded to that there were some things that you'd learned through the years.
Well, yes, they've had technology. You're right about Roswell, and that was one of many incidences where they were able to obtain these craft. One of the things about this, and this does delve into Christianity in a way, you know, Dr. Stan, I think that if it wasn't for Christ and his teachings, we would still be probably fighting with bearskins and stone knives at each other. I think that his teachings were what really helped to take man from a primitive state into one with order. How else could 6 billion people live on one planet without killing each other off? But what I'm getting at is that the point is, his message hasn't permeated all the different races, and especially when you're, I think you're talking about these kinds of beings, what we consider is an honorable deal, to them, does not compute, to put it in any other better way. So in other words, when a deal was made for limited abductions in exchange for technology back in the 40s, you know, we did it based on our own frame of reference, our own paradigm, and what we thought was right, because we really didn't have any point of view to work from.
No, you're suggesting then that there was some sort of an arrangement made between the leaders of our government under the Truman and subsequent administrations to exchange technology for the ability to experiment on human beings. Is this your contention?
That's correct.
All right.
And this has been confirmed by a number of different sources.
I
think Stanton Friedman is another one who also has stated this to be the case.
Well, now, who is Stanton Friedman?
Stanton Friedman is a Canadian. He was, last I knew, up in the Toronto area. He knows the truth about many of these matters, which, of course, are, you know, much too numerous to get into on your show here. I didn't want to, you know, digress too far from the subject.
All right.
So, but I guess my point is this, that, you know, many people said, oh, they broke the agreement, you know, the Greys broke the agreement and so forth. Well, again, it's a frame of reference. You know, if you don't have the same moral values, if one race doesn't have the same moral values as another one, how can one, you know, use the same frame of reference?
All right, now, you feel that these are aliens from some other planet, or do you think these are demonic manifestations?
Well, you know something? That's an excellent point you bring up. There are apparently numerous aspects of this phenomenon. It's not strictly a physical one. There are what you might call demonic aspects. Those abductions, they stop cold when people invoke the name of Christ, or they say, no, you know, I'm not volunteering for this. But the physical ones, such as what's happened to us here, those don't stop, you know, any more than you could chase off Hitler and his henchmen by saying no or invoking Christ. You know, it doesn't work. It works in the spiritual world, but it doesn't necessarily work in the physical one.
Well, you think that, of course, the description of your wife's experience where the Greys were there, but there were also military officers. Do you believe that there are certain people in our military that are in league or certainly trying to utilize this supernatural force?
Yeah, it's more commonly known as a shadow government. That's who these people really are part of. And
this would be a certain element within the military you're speaking of now. Not the whole military, but a certain element within would have sort of gone over to the dark side, like we know, for instance, Colonel Aquino, who was, of course, a colonel in military intelligence, was also part involved with the Temple of Seth and the Church of Satan, and he was, of course, involved. He was at least charged with pedophilia when he was at the Presidio, and then, of course, allowed to retire. My understanding, he still heads occult organizations throughout America. Is this what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it goes pretty deep, and in fact, many of the listeners will recall what happened in the fall of 2001 when Bush said that he is activating the shadow government. Well, and of course we know that there were a couple congressmen who refused to even enter the facilities of the shadow government.
All right, fine. Well, now, why don't you tell our listeners, though, what happened to your wife, and then we could perhaps talk about what happened specifically to you.
Okay. What I'd like her to tell you in her words, you know, and let her say it, because she has a fair amount of detail. She keeps a journal, so she has, you know, she knows pretty clearly what took place with her and how this took place in steps. And before I was to, you know, give the discussion over to her, I'd like to say that we do know that people of American Indian descent or lineage are often the targets of abduction.
No, those who certainly would be in the more occult, the occult religions that many of the Indians were would be more susceptible to this sort of thing. They were always, of course, calling on the great spirits. Would you think that would be the factor there?
You know, that's a really good point you bring up there, because when they call on the great spirit, do they realize what great spirit they're calling on?
Well, I don't think that they do. And of course, that was why, of course, that Thomas Jefferson and so many others tried to bring the Indians to a personal relationship with the Lord. Well, is there anything else you want to tell us about your experience, or should we talk to your wife's experience?
Well, I think maybe what happened to me was apparently, it wasn't really all that pleasant. She did know for a fact it happened. She heard it. And maybe the best thing might be to let her, describe to you what happened.
All right, fine. Why don't you put your wife on? And this is Kathleen, and this is Kathleen Treitmeyer. And whereabouts do you live, Kathleen? What part of the country are you in?
We live in Bloomfield, New York, just outside Rochester.
Okay, fine. And, of course, do you hear our programs there? We have a number of stations we are on there in the Rochester market.
Yeah, I hear it a lot.
Okay, fine. Well, then, of course, you can probably identify with some of what we say. So why don't you tell us, what your experiences were and how you got involved with this? Or how you were involved inadvertently without your knowledge or consent?
Okay. I had written this down, so I should. There's a couple things I want to point out first. I should point out that each abduction had the same beings present. They could be described as four fingers on each hand with spindly legs. The head was much larger than the body for its size.
Did they have these big eyes that we see characterized in the pictures of the grays?
Yes.
Did it look like a typical gray?
No, it had a body. Its head was much bigger than its body was for its size, and they did have a nose and a mouth, but I didn't see any teeth. But they had large black eyes, and it reminded me like of emerald shining. You know, you could almost see right through their eyes. You know, you could see yourself in their eyes, like they're staring right through you. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Okay.
Well, how did it happen you came in contact with these beings, whatever they are?
Okay. Well, I've known about alien abductions through my husband and through everything he reads and stuff, and I always thought that was an exciting thing anyway, but I always believed they were real. I never doubted that there wasn't.
Well, had you read about them? Do you think that...
No, my husband knows... my husband knew a lot about it.
All right.
But that... You know, for years he was telling me that, but I always said, oh, well, they sound interesting. I wouldn't mind meeting them. You know, it didn't bother me.
You shouldn't have said that.
I know. my husband had warned me about their telepathic abilities that could be led to an abduction. The first incident, I was led into a large room.
No, but wait a minute. How did this all happen? I mean, how did you get to your home and dive into a large room?
Yeah, okay. I understand what you're saying. I was laying in bed sleeping, and I woke up, and there was this bright, bright light, just like a beam of light.
How do you know you weren't dreaming at the time?
Well, I wasn't actually dreaming. At first, I thought maybe that was the case, until I was let in. I opened my eyes, and I was in this large room. I mean, just this large room, like this real sterile.
Well, we're going to be back in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, it was in this large room, and it just had one chair, which they sat me in. I could not move. The chair looked like it was mounted on a post, but my feet didn't reach the ground. And they spoke kindly to me, and I was told that they would help me.
Now, of course, were they speaking in English? Did they actually speak words that you could hear?
I could hear this. And this is the surprising part about it, is that I really, really thought at first I was dreaming until the rest of the story comes out. It was just, but, so they just wanted to learn about us. In this incident, a calendar suddenly appeared in mid-air that showed me June 2003. It was not explained to me what that meant, and I still don't know. They said it would be something drastic that would happen to me and my husband. Whenever I asked them something, or anytime I asked something, they would look at each other but wouldn't say anything to figure out what to respond with. No matter what, there was never an answer. The second time, because I was taken three times.
Well, but what happened? Did they just talk to you?
Yeah, they were very nice. They examined me, but they were very nice. They didn't hurt me at all. I didn't have any horrible nightmares about it. I was just really surprised.
By examining you, was there any sexual connotation?
Yeah, they examined me, you know, my women organs and my mouth, my ears.
Did they try to take anything from
you?
Did they perhaps try to harvest some of your eggs, something of that sort?
Mm-hmm. Well, what they did do is I noticed some puncture marks, and they took some blood, what I can say blood, and they took a swab of my women organs.
All right.
Okay, and they couldn't take any eggs because I don't have any.
All right. All right, we're going to be back in just a moment here.
Okay.
We're going to just... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking right now to Kathleen Twightenmeyer, who, of course, listens to our programs back in the Rochester area in New York, and she and her husband, Ted, are telling about their experience with alien abduction. And for those of you who feel that these are strange things, and you really need to read Chuck Missler's book, which we carry, Alien Abductions. And, of course, there have been literally thousands of these recorded. And the interesting thing is they almost all have the same background to them. And, of course, this is why it's so interesting, and I wanted you to have an opportunity to hear somebody tell the story. So, basically, they all have something to do with reproduction and sexuality. And so, anyway, go ahead and tell the story, Kathleen.
Okay, so they never really gave me an answer what June of 2003 would be. But the reason I do these things by little, because I write a journal every day.
All right, fine. Now, when did this first abduction take place?
It was, it was last year, winter of last year.
Okay, fine. And so did you suddenly find yourself back in bed?
Yes, I did, actually.
But you're sure it wasn't just a dream?
Yeah, actually, I thought it was a dream till it happened again. That's...
Were there any marks on you? Or
yeah, I had some marks where my arm is and where my hip is. And because I realize the reason I know this is because with my disease, I always look for a different thing, you know, marks and things to be wrong with me. You know what I mean?
Right.
So we keep track of what's going on with me every day. So at first I thought maybe I was dreaming it. I will say I thought maybe it was just this big hoax in this dream, because I've heard a lot about it, and I'm sure everybody reads books and stuff about it.
All right, fine. So you find yourself back in bed, and then, of course, you tell your husband about it. And so then what happens? Now, this is the winter of last year.
Mm-hmm. So then there was another time, and this is why I was convinced it wasn't a dream the first time. The second time, I was taken in the fall of last year. I woke up in a bright room. It was brighter than anything I've ever seen. I was unable to move. These being grays with slanted eyes were present. Instruments came down from the ceiling, which really scared me. Then I knew I wasn't dreaming. The first time this happened, nothing painful was done. The next time it happened this year, about 6 months later, I was taken to the same place. They were using probes into my mouth and my genital area and took blood. They took a hair sample and also looked into my mouth. They seemed to be in a hurry and handled me somewhat roughly.
All right, fine. Were there any military officers there at that time?
Well, the third time is when they were there.
All right, fine.
Each time I was abducted, I was taken for a longer time period. I did notice that.
But, of course, when you actually got back and you checked yourself the next day, were there any signs that you were sure that something happened, that it wasn't just a dream? In other words, were there areas of puncture marks for taking blood, things like that?
Mm-hmm. And there was also physical signs, because I know a lot about my, you know, my anatomy. I noticed each time that it was taken, I was in extreme pain the next day, like in my, you know, women organs, and I had a lot of physical pain. It physically really hurt. So I kind of knew. It became very much apparent.
All right.
All right.
And so then what happened after the third time that you were, was the third time very similar to the other two?
No, on the third abduction a few months ago, I heard my husband screaming since we've been married almost 30 years now. I knew it was him. Now, I was sure, now I'm positively of this, that I know it was him. However, I couldn't see him. Upon returning to my bed, he was not there yet. It terrified me, and I was so drained of energy, I fell asleep. Following morning, he was back in bed again. This told me he really was present in the place I was taken to. The reason I knew this happened this way is because I keep a journal each day. Also present were three military men sitting against the wall, not saying a word. They were just there. They were just watching and taking notes. Their uniforms appeared to be dark blue or black. They must have been officers.
All right, look, we're going to be back in just a moment or two. Our guest this evening is Kathleen Friedmeier, and we'll be talking to her and to her husband when we get back here, and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. This is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is a little unusual. We have the opportunity to talk many, many times about these alien abductions with people who have written about them, but this is the first time we've actually had a chance to talk to anybody who's had this experience in themselves. So, Kathleen, you believe there were some military officers there, or at least some people in uniforms, dark blue uniforms, taking notes as to what was going on, and then what happened?
Well, because one was decorated, I knew that they were military because my son was in the Navy, and I knew the bars, you know, the bars on the suits. Also, on this occasion in the morning, I told my husband what happened. He looked me over for marks, and on the back of my right arm were two puncture marks, one beside the other. It apparently hit a vein because of the black and blue line that extended above about an inch below these marks. On the third occasion, less than 3 months ago, another examination was just like the second time. They kept relentlessly probing and poking me, looking for something.
All right, fine. And of course, you say that you think your husband was there at the time.
Right. On a recent occasion, I was watching TV in the living room about 2:30 a.m. Her Pomeranian began to bark. She doesn't miss much. Our living room window, which are fairly tight, began to rattle. Heard a noise like a bang. Immediately I got up and looked down the hall. There was a bright light coming from the bedroom. When I entered the room, my husband was gone, including his CPAP machine. first I went down to the basement thinking that maybe he
Not a CPAC. What is a CPAC machine?
It's a machine that helps him breathe.
Okay, fine.
Just a second. His CPAC machine was gone.
All right,
so I went downstairs to think maybe he walked past me and went downstairs to fix it because he had been asleep. But it turned out he wasn't downstairs, and when I looked back in the bedroom, he wasn't there. And then I didn't talk to him till the next morning, and he was back. After each abduction, I woke up the next morning in terrible pain.
All right, fine. And so what happened to your husband then? Do you have any idea?
He came back. He didn't really say too much about it. I knew that in one occasion it was him screaming, but this was another occasion, and he didn't really say too much. So.
All right, well, does he want to tell us what happened, Timer? Does he remember?
Yeah, well, he's on the line.
All right. Well, Ted, did you remember what happened this last time your wife talks about?
Well, I began to get memory fragments of that incident, which she seemed to know right away when I described them to her. One fragment, for example, it was like a stand at four, maybe five levels to it. And there was a sack-like object hanging off each arm on each level. So there was like, I don't know, five or six on each level. And, you know, one of the memory fragments is one of the grays taking one of these objects off the stand and coming over to me. That's as far as it goes. And she asked me if I had also noticed the long tube that's connected to it, which I didn't. So I guess that's pretty self-explanatory. The interesting thing, Dr. Stan, that I noticed is that most men in this world, you know, one of the first things they do when they get up in the morning is head to the bathroom. And I did that out of habit and discovered there was nothing there, that they had apparently completely evacuated me of that during that incident. And I think that was about the only time in my life when, you know, I'd been in bed 6 or 8 hours and got up in the morning and nothing could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of got me interested in, you know, it's just, wow, now this is pretty amazing. I'm pretty outspoken. You know, I don't know if this is a form of punishment or what have you, but that they're doing this, but, you know, if you've done a search of my name on the web, you'll find I've written some articles that have been published on Joyce Riley's website, and one on ABC and other places where I speak out just as you do.
Oh, Chris, what are you speaking out on?
I speak out against, like, the New World Order, which is, as we know, a purely evil, satanically oriented means of controlling the entire population. I think that's the quickest way to sum it up.
Okay, I certainly wouldn't disagree with that at all. So you've been writing out on this for some time, then?
Oh, yes. And I had, discussions on a service called Pal Talk, you know, where you can address large groups of people orally. It's a free service on the web and in other places. Because I see what's happening to America, and like you, it's a pretty terrible thing what's being done to subvert our freedom. And, you know, you would think you'd have the ability. I think the unfortunate thing about abductions is, you know, most things in life, you have that, you know, wide awake, free ability to decide what it is, you know, you want to do. And the business of taking people when they're in deep sleep totally negates that entire process of free will and free choice. You're just an unwilling participant.
Well, do you remember anything that specifically happened other than, you know, that you were there and that this fellow or this creature came over to you? And, I mean, did they take blood? Or did they take any, you suggested they took urine. Did they take anything else from you?
Well, I can't say I remember everything that happened, you know, in that case. I'm sure it'll surface. You know, it'll come back up over a period of time, I imagine.
You know, what you're really saying is you're getting flashbacks to sort of remember what did happen. But yeah, of course, there are techniques that they have to make memories disappear.
That's right. They can give you what's often called a screen memory. You get a dream or some image that covers up the real thing that happened. And if it's pretty horrific, as she's described it, because I wouldn't willingly submit myself to this kind of torment. I can imagine I was screaming. I can just imagine what I was probably saying. And
of course, did you call upon the word of the Lord, or did you even think of that? You know, under the fear, obviously, you would be under a tremendous amount of fear.
Well, that's it. And if I had the ability to do so, I would call upon the word of the Lord to cast them out. You know, get them out of my life. But if it's a physical thing, you know, just like an ordinary abduction of a child by a human being, you know, much as I don't want to say this, it probably, you know, would not be effective in getting rid of them. If it's a spiritual thing, absolutely right. It would get them out of your life.
Well, do you think that this is a spiritual thing, or what do you think it is?
I think it's physical. I have every reason to believe it's physical. She's seen the same beings each time, you know. But
does that mean that they are not demonic beings?
I'm sorry.
I mean, do you think that these are demonic beings that you're encountering, manifestations of evil?
Well, I don't think these particular ones are. I think they're part of the shadow government, which is a very real, very physical entity.
But don't you think that perhaps the shadow government emerges into this organized evil?
Oh, I agree with you. I agree they're part of it. They're sort of the physical, I guess you could say, the physical manifestation of the spiritual evil. Maybe that's
right.
One good way of putting it. You know?
Well, yes, we get the things, in fact, for our listeners out there. We actually get a little pamphlet that's put out by the Luciferians. It's called The Spiritual Hierarchy, and it goes into the who really rules the world. Now, these people are actually the writings of Alice Bailey, but of course they're recently distributed by the Lucius Trust that used to be the Lucifer Publishing House. If any of our listeners would like a copy of the little pamphlet that they put out telling about how their people are in key positions in the government and in the in finances and in certainly in education and in business, you just call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you're a member of the Radio Liberty family, next time you write to us, just ask for the pamphlet, The Spiritual Hierarchy. And of course, we're just going to give you what the Luciferians are sending out to their people across America. They're organized. In fact, they have all sorts of influence in our society today. In fact, the most popular book series of modern times is about a boy witch named Miss Harry Potter, who went to Hogwarts school to learn witchcraft. And, of course, this merges right into this whole dynasty of evil that we're talking about, which is, of course, what the world government's really all about. So, well, what have you learned? What is your impression of these experiences you've had?
Well, let me also just quickly add, when she observed me missing, when she was in the living room, because with her disease, she's awake the better part of the night till 4 or 5 in the morning, that there was a resonating vibration. And a large black triangular vehicle known as the TR-3B, well, TR-3 series, they're now past the B. The TR-3 series was built by Lockheed. It's a $1-point-something billion spacecraft, which is called a vehicle, that uses a form of anti-gravity drive. This is, I'm not letting anything out here, this has been in the press for some time. And witnesses that have been underneath it, you know, you hear this resonating kind of a sound like a glum. It makes that type of a noise. And I could see where, you know, that low-frequency noise could rattle windows. So it's a pretty good sign of a direct connection to, you know, this shadow group, if you will. And
now, you think that this is what your wife was sensing, this this humming that she was hearing?
Yeah, she did tell me she heard that hum. She did say that. And
you have no idea where you were. In other words, you were there, and then suddenly you're back in your bed early in the morning.
Yeah, I was gone. How long did you say I was gone? An hour or two, I guess. And
well, what did your wife do? Did she just go to bed waiting for you, or did she? What?
She told me she laid down and cried. She was worried I wasn't coming back.
Okay.
And so that. What was interesting is they took the CPAP machine, and you know, which is controlled positive air pressure. It plugs in the wall. So somebody.
Do you have emphysema or what?
No, well, I have obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay, fine. All right.
Okay. And someone had to physically come and unplug the machine from the wall. So with the flash of light, you know, someone must have come in the room quickly and unplugged it and left. You know, it took me with it. Because when I came back later, everything was back to normal again.
But you remember being gone. Your wife remembers that you were gone for a period of time, and then, of course, you're back to normal, that you're laying in bed with the machine plugged back in.
Yeah, exactly, with the machine plugged back in. So, it's incredible, you know.
Well, of course, have you told this story to other people?
Not to too many other people. One of the reasons I think that, you know, people that are involved in these programs don't come forward is I know someone who actually piloted one of the vehicles they captured. You know, these vehicles are real. Besides the black triangles, which, by the way, are forbidden by law to be even spoken of on British television. They can't even talk about on the radio, the press, TV, or anything.
Well, were they mentioned on the web here? Is anything up on the web about them here in the United States?
Oh, yes, there's
how do you spell Tierra, then?
I'm sorry?
How do you spell Tierra? You said Tierra 3, but...
No, triangle?
Yes. Is it called a triangle?
Yeah, black triangles.
What would they be listed under the web?
Tierra 3B is commonly what they're called.
Now, what is it, Tierra? Is T-I-E-R-R-A?
No, T-R like in Thomas Richard 3.
Mm-hmm.
Three characters, Tierra 3.
TR3
B on the end of it.
Vehicles, okay?
Yeah, B as in boy.
And of course, they are fairly well known to exist here in the United States.
Yes, there's actually been thousands of people who've seen them. They've flown over the Hudson Valley. Famous people like Art Bell have seen them. He spoke one time of he was out in the desert, driving in the desert, and he looked up and saw a large triangular section of the sky was missing. There weren't any stars. And he got out and looked, and he said this thing was maybe 100, 200 feet up, and it just silently went right over him. Made just a very slight noise, I guess. But I guess depending on how close these things are to you as to how much, you know, what you hear, and well, there's a lot of different factors involved there.
All right, fine. We know, of course, that the Germans experimented with flying saucers, you know, 50 years ago.
Yes, they did.
And, of course, these were anti-gravity devices. But, of course, all of this is concealed from the American people. And, of course, we know that there were strong ties between the Third Reich and the occult. That, of course, is what's never brought out. In fact, Winston Churchill did everything he could to keep that from being brought out at the Nuremberg trials, because everybody was supposed to think we were just dealing with the wicked Nazis. But of course, the idea that there was something supernatural behind that what happened, there's Hitler's ability to control other people, that there really are these supernatural forces out there that really are directing the course of world events. I don't think most people are prepared to hear that, and certainly the people who are affiliated with them, that's the last thing they want, is for people to understand that there is a two-dimensional society, the spiritual realm and the realm that we live in.
I got to tell you something interesting that first tipped me off to something going on, and I don't think my wife really wanted to tell me until I showed her this. I woke up that one particular morning with a piece of red elastic material. It was about the color of dentine gum, but we don't have any dentine gum here. It was about the color of that gum, stuck in the hair of my arm, but it stretched like latex. And that's when she began to tell me what had happened to me. And it was interesting because you probably know Travis Walton's Fire in the Sky description.
No, I don't, but you go ahead and tell
me. Okay, I'll tell you that really quickly because I know we're getting late. They had made a movie called Fire in the Sky, and basically what happened, he was gone for several days to the point that his two friends were being accused of murdering him. He was abducted right in front of his two friends out in the woods near Snowflake, Arizona.
Well, I can see why they probably thought he was, you know, murdered him, you know.
Yeah.
If you tell the average person about one of these stories, they're going to laugh at you and say, that couldn't be true, obviously. You're trying to cover up that you did your friend in.
He was gone like 5 days, and he was found naked by the side of a road eventually. But what happened, he described what happened to him. He was held down by a large elastic sheet that covered his entire body. And they put a ring around his left eye and went in near the tear duct with a probe. Of course, I imagine that must have gone into the brain cavity. But it was interesting. When I saw that elastic, I was absolutely dumbfounded by it. You know, it stretched in, it would pop right back again. And I have nothing in the house here that could possibly, you know, where that could possibly come from. And I've never seen anything like it. It wasn't very big. So it was probably when they pulled the sheet off of me that, you know, a piece of it got left behind that they missed.
All right, fine. We have somebody calling from Washington. Oh, do you want to talk to them?
I'd love to.
Okay, fine. This is Ron from Richland, Washington. Hi, Ron. How are you doing?
Sir, I just had a question. I happen to have a video from Bob Lazar.
Oh, yeah.
Is this guy in the level?
Bob? From what I know, he actually is, and I think they went to a lot of trouble to discredit him.
No, of course they would go to, if the stories are true, of course they would have to discredit them, because they could never let the American people know about they're really involved in the spiritual battle. There really are demonic beings, that the Bible is true when they talk about the angels, the sons of man mating with these demonic beings, that, of course, that's what brought on Noah's flood, because the Lord was so upset with the evil that permeated the world at the time of Noah, that he destroyed the world at that time with a great flood. And could that be a premonition to what is happening in the world today? Any other thoughts you had, Ron?
Well, just this one video I have, he talks about down in outside of Las Vegas, Area 51, or whatever, they're trying to reverse engineer some flying saucers and some type of propulsion system that uses element 115, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it will, you know, modifies the space-time continuum or something, and allows
special reactor.
Well, I was just wondering, you know, how much there is to that.
Well, the key thing in the story is really the gravity amplifier, and they have built gravity amplifiers that do work. They're roughly the size of a suitcase. They're not very big.
Well, the thing is that it's hard to know what any individual says, but there is something out there that, and of course these stories are so stereotyped, they've been analyzed by a professor back at Harvard who is not a Christian at all, and of course, but he's seen the similarity between all these various people he's interviewed. It's beautifully told in Chuck Missler's book, Alien Abductions. So,
they mean Alien Encounters.
Alien Encounters, right.
Yeah,
And incidentally, we do carry that book if any of our listeners would like to get a copy.
I also wanted to add that, this is important, you know, they're using us as a DNA library and as a resource for food, and I don't mean cannibalism, I'm talking about using partially digested matter from the human digestive tract, because the Greys from what I've learned, can't, you know, fully process food the way we can. But the thing about the DNA issue is that they can't create DNA. They have to get it from somewhere. Only the Creator, only God can make DNA. I think this is important to know, because why else would they go to so much trouble? They can't make it themselves. They have to go get it from somewhere.
Well, Ron, do you have anything else you wanted to ask?
Well, I just remember another video I watched. They interviewed Dave Hunt, and he said the stories of some of these alien encounters are similar to the stories in the Middle Ages about people with some type of demonic activity.
Well, I think the whole thing is demonic to me.
He said there's a lot of similarity, and that's what he thinks is going on.
Well, I think that Dave's such a pretty smart guy. And of course, he's a lot smarter than I am and a much better theologian than I am. But I certainly believe that this whole thing is a manifestation of evil, and we're only seeing glimpses of it, little glimpses here or there, where the people are willing to come forward and telling their stories, because most people wouldn't want to tell these stories because, of course, it'd be opening themselves to ridicule. And I can never forget when there was a man here and this county where I live many years ago was talking about having been abducted a number of times. When I first heard the story, I thought, boy, this guy's really got to be, you know, crazy as a loon. But only now, looking back through the years, and I figured, well, maybe he wasn't crazy. So many other people have told similar stories. And then when you understand the spiritual nature of the battle, you can begin to understand that we will at times catch glimpses of the spiritual forces at work on society. Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, sir.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, we've just got a few minutes here. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners, Ted or Kathleen?
Well, parting thoughts are don't ask for something that you might not want. Is maybe the first thought.
I think that Kathleen had said that her thought was, gee, that sounds sort of exciting. But, of course, that's never what you want to think about this, because when you realize that these are encounters with evil, then, of course, it changes your whole desire. You don't want to confront evil. That is not our job.
Well, my parting thought is that one other reason that I know what happened to me happened is because of the physiological changes between the MRIs and the blood test.
And what has happened then?
Well, my MRIs went from, like, having 2 lesions, and within 6 months you have 14 lesions. And if you know anything about multiple sclerosis, it's a very slow, progressive disease. Now, I inherited it from my dad and my brother, and I was going right down the same lines. We all got it in our 40s. But suddenly, I have a lot more lesions than they've ever had their whole entire process of having the disease. And the blood tests and the spinal taps were different.
Okay, fine. If I could just suggest, if you ever have a chance to go to Dr. Garth Nicholson's website, that's imed.org, imed.org, I believe it is, or .com, but I believe it's .org. And he, of course, has some suggestions there, atypical for MS, but organized medicine really has no effective treatment for it. You might just check his website, Kathleen, and see. He's a very, very smart man.
We're familiar with Dr. Scott's work, too.
Right. Well, good. Well, of course, you listen to our program, you'll hear these people on, and, of course, there's so much here that we don't understand. But, of course, we can see this hand of these wicked and evil people in so much of what's going on today. Well, look, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to be with us this evening. Is there any last thing you'd like to say to our listeners?
Thank you very much for having us on your show.
God,
thank you.
Kathleen and Ted, thank you both for being with us. God bless you both.
God bless you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Ted and Kathleen Toitmeyer from the Rochester area, where they listened to our programs back there on the Sunshine Network, and they'd called me. And when you hear the story, you know, and you say, could this sort of be true? Is this simply imagination? Is this dreams? But when you hear similar stories from in the Chuck Missler's book, Alien Encounters, and of course we have many, many, we have another book, I'd call it, maybe it's Alien Abduction. We have several books on this subject, but my people have really analyzed it. Then you begin to realize, as you begin putting things into a spiritual context, that it's not that far removed from what it tells us in the book of Genesis about what happened during the time of Noah. So don't simply scoff and pass these things off. We have a wonderful video. It's called Deceived, and it's a story. It's a, certainly is a fictional story with Lou Gossett Jr., put out by some Christians about, of course, the government agencies actually trying to tap into the occult. If you want to have a wonderful evening, if you even have it in video or in DVD, but Lou Gossett Jr. and a cast of really a wonderful cast of actors, a gripping story, and of course there's a Christian message to this whole thing, because there are people in our military, we know for a fact, that have been trying to tap into the occult. And of course, this is something you certainly don't want to take lightly, and you don't want to try to get involved in on your own. And so this is the time when we just want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Of course, we hope that some of you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and get our four best tapes of the month and get our newsletter on a regular basis and help us as we reach out 5 hours every day trying to educate people about the truly spiritual battle in which we're engaged today. And lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here out across America at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we're going to have with us a very special guest. His name is Don Richardson, and we've talked to him one time before, but we wanted to have a full hour with him to talk about his new book, The Secrets of the Quran. Now, Don had, of course, been a missionary. He lived among the Muslims for many years, and, of course, he then witnessed the change in the attitude of the Muslims, you know, from being tolerant of him as a Christian to an increasingly militant form of Islam during the years, of course, he was in the mission field. Don, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Don, are you there? Oh, we lost Don. Oh, we're going to have to get Don back again. If you would mind just calling him back again. I don't know how that happened, but I think it's so important that we understand, Don has had a chance to live among the Muslims, to study the Quran, something that most of us are not going to have a chance to do. And as you begin to read his information that he presents us, really it gives you tremendous insight into how the Muslim religion can be utilized to create this radical belief. Don, are you there?
Yes, hello there, Dr. Stan.
Hey, thank you so much for being with us again. And, of course, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are and how it was that you happened to live such a period of time with the Muslims and come in contact with them.
Yes, in 1962, my wife Carol and I were in our mid-20s, and we went out to Indonesia, lived in the eastern end of Indonesia, a part of the island of New Guinea, and a year after we arrived there, Muslims began moving into that area. So from 1963 onward, I've been interacting with Muslims who were government officers, soldiers, policemen. And then later, I was able to travel to other parts of Indonesia, which is the world's most populous Muslim nation, and then even to Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, and other places. Plus, living right here in America since 1977, I've been interacting with Muslims who are right in this neighborhood. The lady who cuts my hair is a Muslim lady from Iran, and the one who does my California sales tax report is a Muslim CPA from Egypt. So that plus the reading I've done has given me the background to write Secrets of the Quran.
All right, fine. It's a fascinating book. Now, of course, has there been a change in the thrust of the Muslim religion since the early 60s to where it is today?
Well, in Indonesia, in the 1960s, you never met a radical Muslim. And no Christian churches were ever burned, and Christians were not fired from their jobs saying, if you want to be rehired, come back a Muslim. But then in the 70s and 80s, 90s, it seems that oil money from Saudi Arabia began to sponsor teachers coming to influence Indonesian Muslims through their seminaries, teaching in the mosques, calling for them to adopt a more radical position, because they began to realize many Muslims in Indonesia were converting to Christianity, and they said this just has to stop, and whatever it takes to stop it is what we must implement. So, especially in the late 80s and 90s, churches began to be burned. Just 2 years ago, on Christmas Eve, there were 25 bombs set off to destroy church buildings while worshipers were inside celebrating New Year's Eve, Christmas Eve. And so this began to be very noticeable. And more recently, I found out that the radicalization that is happening in many circles of the Islamic world is coming out of Saudi Arabia. 250 years ago, there was a Muslim cleric named Wahhab, and the teaching that he inspired is called Wahhabism. And Wahhab noticed that what was previously the great Islamic empire that flourished from the 700s up into the 1200s was in decline, and what he perceived as Christian Europe was striving ahead and becoming the most dominant force in the world. So he tried to analyze why was Islam losing prestige and losing its power in the world. And his analysis was this. When the Muslim armies first burst out of the Arabian Peninsula in the late 600s, early 700s, they were focused upon jihad, holy war. And they wielded the sword, and they spread Islam by force and often compelled conversion by force, and they swept their enemies out of the way. They took control. Within 100 years after Muhammad's death, they took control of all of North Africa, Spain and Portugal, even invaded southern France. They also moved eastward as far as Pakistan, and by this very rapid holy war established the beginnings of the Islamic Empire, which was to last for many centuries. So Wahhab said jihad was the key. But once we had made those conquests, he said, we began to be complacent and be content just to honor the so-called five pillars of Islam, praying five times a day, almsgiving, pilgrimage to Mecca, etc. And so he said, because we put jihad on the shelf, so to speak, Islam began to lose, and it steadily lost its place, its power, its prestige. And Christian Europe is now dominating the scenes around the world. This, the expansion of the British Empire, the Dutch colonial empire, the French and German enterprises. And so what did Wahhab conclude? He began to teach, we've got to get back to jihad. We've got to make jihad supreme, the supreme duty of Muslims, even more the duty of Muslims than the five pillars of Islam. He wrote his articles, he preached his sermons, and this became the basis of the Wahhabi sect of Islam, which has taken control of Islam all through Saudi Arabia. Now, there's a book about this besides the one that I wrote, Dr. Stan. It's by a former Israeli delegate to the United Nations, Dori Gold.
Oh, that's Hatred's Kingdom. Yes, we carry that book.
Yes, Hatred's Kingdom. That book, along with Secrets of the Quran, shows what the Western civilization is up against, because the Wahhabi clerics preaching fiery anti-American, anti-Christian, anti-Jewish sermons in the mosques throughout Saudi Arabia are taking control of that, of the destiny of that important nation. The Saudi princes are under their thumbs. Now, the Saudi princes are noted for spending hundreds of billions of dollars building extra palaces for their own luxurious existence, buying 747 jets and outfitting them opulently for shopping trips to Paris and London. But the Wahhabi clerics have laid down the law saying, this must stop. You are wasting the resources that Allah has given to Islam to dominate the world, to put Islam back at the top where it used to be. And so they are demanding that hundreds of billions of dollars of oil money be turned over to them, and it is under their control, and they are using it to fund, well, first of all, they built three universities, two in Medina, one in Mecca, and they are sending agents out to Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, even as far as Mongolia, and over to other parts of the world, offering a free university education to bright young men from poor families. And of course they say, yes, of course we want a free education. Fine, we're offering it to you, but you have to come to Saudi Arabia to receive it. So these hundreds of young men gathered from nations around the world are spirited away to Mecca and Medina. There they are indoctrinated with the Wahhabi brand of Islam, which is a warmongering, jihad-emphasizing kind of Islam. And then once they graduate from the university, they are fully funded to go back to the nations they came from to try to radicalize moderate mosques and their congregations, and to start new mosques, if there are none, new mosques which also teach Wahhabi Islam. And the Wahhabis are using millions and millions of dollars to build beautiful mosques, stately buildings, in hundreds of cities of the world that Islam seemed to show no interest in until just these last few decades.
And of course, it includes the United States and building the mosques and training their missionaries, their radical Islamic clerics to go into the prisons of America and radicalize the blacks of America. They're teaching them, of course, that Christianity is the white man's religion, but the Mohammedan faith is the religion of the black man. And of course, once they can get them recruited into the jihad, they will, of course, become the stormtroopers of the onslaught in America.
That seems to be the intent. Charles Colson has written expressing concern about that possibility.
And of course, the thing is that this has been encouraged, and most incredible thing by our own government, which of course changed the immigration laws in 1965 to encourage Muslim immigration. Before that, we had 50,000 Muslims. Now we have probably at least 6 million. But it is the radical mosques that are radicalizing the Muslims who are here. This is the concern, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And here is a major problem. If you know a moderate Muslim, a man who really cares more about just making a good living and getting the best education he can get for his children, that is a Muslim who virtually ignores the teachings of the Quran. And so when a radical comes along, he will ask a moderate Muslim, "Do you believe that every verse of the Quran is inspired by Allah?" And the moderate Muslim has been taught from childhood to say yes to that question. To say, "No, I don't believe that every verse," would make him guilty of apostasy. And this is so frowned upon among Muslims, and is in some areas even a basis for a person to be put on trial and killed. So he will say, "Yes, I do." And then the radical can use that statement as leverage to move him away from a moderate understanding of Islam to a radical one. Because there is no doubt the Quran is on the side of radical Islam, and the Quran is regarded as inspired by God. And once a moderate Muslim discovers that there are more than 100 jihad verses in the Quran, that means one out of every 55 verses in the Quran was dictated by Muhammad to scribes 1,400 years ago, calling Muslims to be ready to wage war against infidels, that is to say, against non-Muslims. And Jews and Christians are not exempted as targets that Muslims may wage jihad against. There are verses, war verses in the Quran that specifically mention Jews and Christians as enemies.
Well, I think even more interesting is that they will actually wage war and kill Muslims who do not agree with their radical form of the Muslim faith. This is the frightening thing.
Yes, indeed. Wahhab really was very much against any Muslim who was not a Sunni Muslim like him. And he waged war against the Shiite Muslims in Iran and part of Iraq and killed thousands of them. And the Wahhabi teachers actually will threaten moderate Muslims if they don't abandon moderation and join the ranks of the radicals. So in America, we really need to think of it as our duty to try to reach the moderate Muslim acquaintances we have in our society, to persuade them before the radicals get to them that they don't have to make that commitment to Muhammad as a prophet and to the Quran as a revelation from God, because Muhammad, in the Quran and in the Hadith, discredited himself. There is no reason why anyone should believe that he's a prophet. When you really know the facts of his life, the deeds that he committed and the crimes that he perpetrated against mankind, then not even a devout Muslim could look at the record and still say that Muhammad is a prophet. And if any Muslim person is listening to my voice right now, I urge you to reconsider your commitment. Muhammad was not the man you have been told that he was. Read my book, Secrets of the Quran, and you will see the evidence, because I quote extensively from Muslim sources to show the crimes that were committed, the atrocities, the beheading of at least 500 Jewish men in Medina in one day, And why did Muhammad order them executed? They were not threatening him. No, there was no reason for Muslims to claim that they needed to kill the Jews in their own self-defense. The Jews simply refused to acknowledge him as a prophet because they could see through his sham. They knew he was no such thing, and they refused to acknowledge him, and for that they were slain. And all the wives of those martyred Jewish men and all their children were taken as slaves by Muhammad and his followers, sold for profit, and the women became sex slaves. There are four verses in the Quran that authorize Muslim men to have sex with female slaves. And this was done, all the Jewish property, all their homes, all their date palm orchards, all their land, taken by the Muslims. And this is what happened to one of three Jewish clans. Before that, two other Jewish clans were attacked and defeated one by one. And Muhammad wanted to have all their males beheaded as well, all the adult males. But at that time, the pagan Arabs living in Medina refused to cooperate with Muhammad. They said, no, you can't kill them. They're our neighbors. We've lived beside them for a long time. We like them. We won't let you kill them. So we had to settle for just driving them out of their homes, away from their own hometown. And same thing with the second clan. And he was enriching himself at the expense of the Jews. But when it came to the surrender of the third Jewish clan, that time he demanded blood. He would not settle for mere banishment, and thus at least 500 Jewish men were beheaded while the women and children stood watching, and then the women were forced to become the sex slaves of the Muhammad and his followers. These were atrocities, and by the way, other Muslim sources say it was more than 500 Jewish men. Other sources say 900, some say even as many as 1,200. And this has been forgotten in so many history books. Jews all over the world remember their martyrs at Masada. They've forgotten their martyrs at Medina. And there were other atrocities. There was an Arab woman in Medina named Asma bint Marwan, and Muslim sources say she was a popular poetess in the city of Medina. Well, when Muhammad came to Medina, claiming to be a prophet, and going out with his followers to maraud caravans passing along the trade routes near Medina, and she saw that more and more pagan Arab men were joining his cult, becoming Muslims in order to share in the plunder, the dividing up of the booty, she became very critical of Muhammad for stirring up so much war and strife where there had been peace. She wrote a poem, actually not directly criticizing Muhammad, but criticizing the men of her own clan for allowing themselves to be misled by this man who was going out to maraud caravans of neighboring people. Well, someone read the poem that she wrote, criticizing the Arabs, calling them, accusing them of acting like seduced women. That's the translation of the Arabic. When the poem was read to Muhammad, he ordered her assassinated. He said, will no one deliver me from this daughter of Marwan? So one of Muhammad's young devotees knew what the prophet wanted. He waited till the middle of the night, took his sword, went into the poetess's house. There she lay among her children, sleeping on mats on the floor. She had just finished nursing her youngest child, an infant, and the mother and the little one had just fallen asleep. Stepping over the sleeping bodies of the other children, this young assassin plunged his sword into the poetess's body, killed her in her sleep, and fled. Well, I guess all the children woke up, found themselves lying in their mother's blood. The next morning, this assassin came to the mosque in Medina and announced to Muhammad, O Messenger of Allah, I have killed her. And Muhammad's response from Muslim sources has him saying, you have served Allah well. And then the young man said, should I fear retaliation? And Muhammad's response to that question was, don't worry about it. not even two goats would butt their heads together over her. Well, that's how much Muhammad believed in freedom of speech. The Jews were assassinated, killed in large numbers, enslaved, driven out of their own homes and properties, and even a woman poetess was not safe from his wrath. And, of course, his followers, seeing all these things, realized that, you know, this was the pattern for them, and this was the beginning of the doctrine of jihad. Now, there's something else that we have to contend with here in America, and that is the attempts of Muslim apologists to try to justify these terrible crimes. And as I've already mentioned, they try to justify the murder of the Jews by claiming that the Jews were threatening Muhammad militarily, and they had to defend themselves. And in the book, I show all the evidence that denies that apologetic. But there's another thing, and that is that Muslim apologists will quote a verse from the second chapter of the Quran where it is written, "There is no compulsion in religion." And in spite of the fact that there are 109 jihad verses that contradict that verse, they will use that verse and say, this is an evidence that no one ever needs to fear warmongering among Muslims because the Prophet said there is no compulsion in religion. Well, if that verse were indeed worth the paper it's printed on, then I guess we could heave a sigh of relief and say, well, if someone is a Muslim and wants to leave Islam, then no one would try to force him to stay. No one would threaten his life for becoming an apostate. Well, Muslims know that that is not the case at all. And we might also think, if that verse was worth anything, that no one ever in the world would ever be forced to convert to Islam. It would have to be a choice of a person's own free will. But here is what the Muslim apologists are not telling the public. There is also in Islam a doctrine called abrogation. And this came about because sometimes Muhammad giving something, reciting something that he claimed was a fresh new revelation from on high, forgot that what he was saying contradicted something he claimed God had given him earlier. But people listening to him began to notice occasional contradictions, and they complained, "Don't you realize that the thing you say Allah is inspiring you to recite today contradicts something that you said he inspired you to recite weeks ago or months ago?" And so I guess Muhammad realized he was caught, and he couldn't deny that there was a contradiction. So right on the spot, as he often did, he invented a doctrine to get himself out of a fix. He claimed to have authority from God, quoting God, saying this, "Can I not give you a good verse today and a better one another day?" And so this is what Muslim theologians seize upon as the basis for a doctrine of abrogation. It's a doctrine that means that God can contradict himself, and whatever he says later takes priority over whatever he might have said earlier.
Now, of course, my understanding is that in the early parts of the Quran, why there are many more or less peaceable remarks, and then, of course, as the Quran was written in parts, and much of it was written later, and was, Muhammad began to gain more and more military prowess, why his statements and his decrees were ever increasingly militant. So by the end of the Quran, why, of course, it doesn't sound like the verses at all in the early part of the Quran. Would that be a fair statement?
It is, Dr. Stan, except for one thing. The Quran is not chronological. Chapter 2 has things in it that were from the later period of Muhammad's life called the Medina period, and everything is mixed up. There are no dates on the books. And so you're reading through, and you come across war verses that were dictated to scribes in the Medina period, and then you come to more peaceful statements that Muhammad dictated to scribes in the earlier period when he was still in Mecca. and you're at a loss to know the chronology. So it's not that all the verses written during his sojourn in Mecca are in the front of the Quran, and all the other verses are in the back of the Quran. No, they're all mixed up.
So that makes it really pretty confusing then, doesn't it?
Extremely confusing. Now let me explain what would make an honest translation of the Quran. If someone would give us a translation of the Quran in which every verse that the translator knows is abrogated by other verses somewhere else, then he should put a little footnote from that verse so that we would know we don't take it seriously. This verse is overruled by other things. And then we'd have the references and we'd go to see what was the final statement that came down from Allah, the one that Muslims know has to be obeyed, and the one that makes the earlier statements irrelevant. But no, they don't want to give us all that knowledge, because then they wouldn't be able to quote the abrogated verses to suit their political purpose whenever they would want to. So they're leaving us in the dark, but you can be sure the verse that says there is no abrogation, there is no compulsion in religion, that is abrogated, because one out of every 55 verses in the Quran calls for the use of violence to spread Islam by force. Five of the verses say this: fight in the cause of God until Islam is the only religion. In other words, Islam must dominate the world and suppress Christianity, suppress Judaism, Buddhism, and Hinduism, and any form of idolatry also, and be the dominant, the only religion in the world.
Well, of course, that's a rather frightening thing, because we know what the history of the Muslim religion is. One time, they actually had taken Spain and were moving into France, and certainly the last great battle was, I think, in 1683. No, yes, I guess they threw them out of Spain in 1492, and then 1683, the great battle before the walls of Vienna, had, of course, the Christian armies not stood, or why we'd all be speaking Arabic today.
Yeah, we'd all be wearing fezes and reading the Quran.
Well, yeah, that's really an amazing, amazing story, and of course, we're going to, of course, be back with our special guest here in just a moment or two. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-464-8295. So you hang on there. We'll be right back. And I think we just lost our guest. I'll ask our producer to call Don back again. And hope you're enjoying this. The book, The Secrets of the Quran, our guest, of course, is Don Richardson. And we'll be back in just a moment. Here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest so far this evening has been Don Richardson. We've been talking about his book, Secrets of the Quran, and it's a fascinating book by a gentleman who's done a lot of studying here, and I think it's so vitally important. You really understand that there's been an organized effort to push this radical form of Islam for many years. Now, this has certainly not been encouraged alone by the Saudi Arabians. It's also been encouraged by our CIA. And those of you who would like to read the book, Dollars for Terror, written in 1999 by a Swiss journalist, a television journalist, who traveled over all throughout the Middle East trying to find out who was funding this whole radical Islamic movement. And we find, of course, the Pakistani intelligence, the Saudi Arabians, but as the gentleman says, the author says in the opening words of his book, also the CIA was well aware of what was going on and in many instances was involved. So here we begin to find this old adage of creating the best enemy money can buy. And, of course, encourages this radical form of Islam being funded by our good friends in Saudi Arabia. And that's really what's so frightening about this whole thing is that, and in fact, of course, we know that Al-Qaeda was funded by the Saudis both before and after September 11th. And if you haven't read Dora Gold's book, you'll find out that you need to get it. It's called Hatred's Kingdom. And he points out that the Saudi princes were meeting with the leaders of Hamas as late as October of last year. And they're probably still meeting with them for that matter. But they were meeting with them in October of last year. And of course, it's Hamas that's doing everything they can to prevent any sort of peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And what do we do? Why, we just go right along. And of course, we demand that the Jews give up more land and more land and more land, the land for peace, until pretty soon there'll be no land at all to give up. And unfortunately, you're dealing with people who have a different worldview. They have no intention of living in peace with the Israelis. They simply want to kill them all or drive them into the sea. Would that be a fair statement, Don?
I think that's quotable right from their websites and from their speeches.
All right, fine. Well, of course, what is the redemptive analogy, or the redemptive analogy, and what does it have to do with the Muslim religion?
Well, a redemptive analogy is something that missionaries have been using for a very long time, even though they didn't all give it a name like that. Redemptive analogy is the name that I applied to the phenomenon in 1973. What it means is, you're coming to people who have never heard of Jesus, and perhaps even never heard of God, the creator of the heavens and the earth, never heard of Jesus dying on the cross, rising from the dead, and your purpose is to teach them about this wonderful plan of God to provide an atonement for the sin of the world through God the Son, Jesus. Well, if you find something in that person's cultural background that is parallel to at least one aspect of this redemptive message, you can use that to establish a foothold. Use that as an eye-opener that may become a heart-opener. And let me give you a couple of examples. When missionaries went to China in this modern missionary era, beginning with Robert Morrison in 1805, learning the Chinese language, they found that it's not a phonetic writing system like ours, it's pictographic. The Chinese writing system employs 214 little pictures that get combined to make words. And interesting messages are hidden in the words according to the way various pictures are combined. For example, the Chinese word pronounced yi, that means righteous, requires you to take two of the 214 pictures and place one over the other. The upper picture has to be the picture that means a lamb. And underneath it, another little picture that means first-person singular pronoun. So what were they really saying when they wrote the word righteous? They are saying, the lamb over me, righteous. Or if you wish, I under the lamb, righteous. So a missionary can use that and ask a Chinese person, notice what your ancestors are indicating. Righteousness comes from being under a lamb. But where is the lamb under whom you and I can be to be righteous? And the Chinese person says, I don't know. How about you, foreigner? Do you know? Enabling us to say, oh, do we have good news for you?
And the Lamb of God.
The Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Well, that's one example. And by the way, there are 150 words in the Chinese language that have spiritually significant messages just like that. The Chinese word for a ship shows a ship with 8 people sailing in it. Don't write any other number than 8. You will lose one mark in the Chinese language exam. Well, why do you suppose the ancestors of the Chinese insisted that it must be 8 people in the ship? According to the book of Genesis, chapters 6, 7, and 8, what was the first ship that ever floated? Noah's Ark. And how many people were delivered from the flood in it? 8 people. Well, the Chinese ancestors apparently knew that. So there are foreshadowings of biblical revelation in a 4,000-year-old writing system from the other side of the world. Now in India, in an ancient body of literature called the Vedas, there are some amazing prophecies that are found in the oldest Vedic writings, not the more recent ones, but things that were written down 3,000 years ago, 3,500 years ago, even 4,000 years ago. And here's an amazing example. Picture a Job-like person writing this. Somewhere in the world, there's an upside-down tree.
Well, now let's ask, what can cause a tree to be upside down? A tornado, perhaps? A hurricane? Or a bulldozer? Not this time. This is a tree that is upside down because it is rooted in heaven, but its branches spread out over the earth, yielding fruit for mankind. Then it goes on to say, the trunk of the upside-down tree will be gashed, and the sap that bleeds from the wound in the side of the upside-down tree is for the healing of mankind. What a strange metaphor. In spite of its strangeness, that is a metaphor that reminds you and me of Jesus.
And, of course, the crucifixion on the tree, of course.
Yes. He is the one who is rooted in heaven and who offers good things to mankind, and he is the one whose side was pierced, that shed his blood for the healing of mankind from the disease of sin.
And of course, what you're saying, Dan, of course, there is within all of the religions at least this awareness of the biblical story. We know that, for instance, the Karen people in Burma had been waiting for through the ages for this white man to come. Who was Jedediah Dudson, came, I guess, in the
yes.
in the early 1800s.
1829, yes.
As a missionary to them, to bring them the word of Christ. But they were waiting for him because they knew he was going to come to tell them about the one true God. This is
yes.
passed down from generation to generation.
And he was supposed to come from the West.
Right.
And the book of God would be white. Well, when they first saw the Bible in the hand of Adoniram Judson, they thought, that's a black book. Look, it has a black cover. But as soon as Judson opened it, they saw the white inside, and they said, ah, that is the book of God that we've been waiting for. This is a story that I tell in one of the chapters of my book, Eternity in Their Hearts. Well, another example, Dr. Stan, of a redemptive analogy, is one that my wife, Carol, and I found among the Sawi. When I first told them the story of Judas betraying Jesus to death, they thought that Judas was the hero of the story. They said, that man Judas, the one who betrayed his friend with a kiss, he's the sort of man we call a tade duan, a master of treachery. And they wanted me to tell them more about Judas.
And of course, they liked the master of treachery. He was sort of a hero to them.
He was a hero, yeah. They said, he's the sort of man any one of us would be proud to promise a daughter to in marriage. But later, I discovered that their way of making peace required a father in one of two warring villages to make an incredible sacrifice. He had to be willing to take one of his own children and give that child as a tarotin, that's a Sawi phrase that means a peace child, to a father in the enemy village. And he would not raise his child anymore. His child would be raised in the home of a family in what was the enemy village. But as long as that peace child remained alive in that other community, there would be no violence. No one would wage war. In other words, unless a man was willing to make that ultimate sacrifice, his expressions of friendship were suspect, but that sacrifice annulled all suspicion and made a lasting peace possible. And I actually saw it happen in January 7th, 1963. We watched as a father finally decided to honor my request that the war raging between two villages be brought to an end, and he picked up not one of several children, Stan. He had only one child. He and his wife had waited years to welcome with just one baby, and because it took them so long to have one child, for all they knew, there was some physical, medical reason why they would never have another child. Nevertheless, he gave an only child as a peace child, and I stood watching, saying to myself, what is this? A father giving a son, an only son of that, to his enemies for the purpose of reconciliation. There's something familiar about this, and then it hit me. Whereas I could not describe Jesus to the Sawi as the Lamb of God because they'd never seen a sheep, I realized I could describe him as the Tarotin Kadon, the greatest peace child. I used that analogy, and it helped the Sawi people to see that there's a greater Father, God, the creator of all things, who gave a greater peace child, his own son, Jesus, to reconcile man to himself and each man to his brother. So the tribe began to respond to the gospel of Jesus as the perfect personal fulfiller of their own uniquely Sawi peace child ideal. And whereas the peace secured by the giving of a little Sawi baby lasted only as long as that baby lived, and that was a problem because 2 out of every 3 babies in those days didn't even live to 5 years of age. Now they have an ever-living peace child because Jesus is the one who died once for the sin of the world, but then he rose again from the dead, and in the words of Hebrews 7:25, he ever lives. Jesus ever lives to make intercession for those who come unto God through him. Now, redemptive analogies work in China, in the midst of Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism. Redemptive analogies work in India, where ever so many people now are finding Jesus to be the fulfillment of that upside-down tree analogy. It also works in among tribal people like the animistic Sawi. But when it comes to using redemptive analogies to lead Muslims to acknowledge the true Savior of the world, that's where we have a problem, because whichever biblical truth you would seek to use, something from a Muslim's background to lead that Muslim to see the need of Jesus and the true nature of God and the way of salvation, lo and behold, you bring the Muslim there, and to your dismay, you find Muhammad got there ahead of you, and he redefined everything. Muhammad redefined the nature of God. God in the Quran, God in Muslim traditions called the Hadith, does not have the same attributes as God in the New Testament. So you get frustrated because things have been redefined. You would use an analogy of Jesus as the one who died for the sin of the world, but Muhammad has taught Muslims to believe Jesus didn't die. The atoning death of Jesus, the most important thing in the entire biblical revelation, was denied by him. And even you talk to someone about heaven, to awaken a desire to go to heaven, a place of purity. Muhammad has already redefined heaven as a celestial brothel filled with beautiful dark-eyed virgins, and Muslim men, especially those who are martyred fighting for Islam, engaging in jihad, have paid the door price. They're the first to get in, and they have eternal, celestial, sensuous pleasure with those dark-eyed virgins. So the pure Judeo-Christian heaven is redefined, and it's as if when Muhammad borrowed doctrines from the Bible, it was as if he was downloading them into the Quran, and later Muslims downloaded them into the Hadith. A virus got into the software then, and distortions resulted, so that things that are in the Bible are so different when you find them in the Quran. Let me give you another example. This time it relates to the way Muhammad borrowed from the Old Testament. In the Quran, in just the first 89 chapters of the Quran, Muhammad tells the story of the Exodus, Moses' confrontation with Pharaoh in Egypt and Israel's exodus from Egypt. He tells that story 27 times in the first 89 chapters. Well, divide 27 into 89, and what do you get? You get the same story once in every 3.3 chapters, and this is just one evidence of an enormous amount of repetition that is in the Quran. There's nothing in all of human literature that is more repetitive than the Quran. I can give you other examples later if you wish. But here is the awesome thing about the 27 renditions of the Exodus story in the Quran. In all 27 tellings of the Exodus story, there is not one mention of the Passover. And Muhammad must have known about the Passover, because Jews living in the Arabian Peninsula, Jews living in especially the city of Medina, celebrated the Passover every year. And pagan Arabs knew about the Passover, but Muhammad was not willing to acknowledge it. So even as he denied the atoning sacrifice that secured Israel's deliverance from Egypt in the Passover account, then in the New Testament he also denied the atonement offered by Jesus Christ. So he was very much against the doctrine of the atonement. Yes, he acknowledged the virgin birth of Jesus. Yes, he acknowledged that Jesus was sinless. Yes, he acknowledged that Jesus was able to
make a clay bird. Now, this is a miracle he invented. This is not in the Bible. He just made this up. But he said Jesus formed a bird out of clay and then spoke to it, and the clay bird became a living bird that flew away. Well, that is a little fiction, but it does indicate that Jesus had power to give life to inanimate matter. And that is something no other prophet is credited with doing. So,
even Muhammad couldn't have done that.
No. He couldn't. In fact, he couldn't work any miracle. The only miracle that Muslims claim for Muhammad was the writing of the Quran. But that isn't much of a miracle when you realize that, you know, half of it is a repetition of the other half. And if all the repetitions, if all the stories told in the Quran a dozen or more times were told only once, I suppose the entire Quran would boil down to about 50% of its length.
Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling us from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing tonight?
Hi, Stan. Thanks for having Don Richardson on. He brings us a most needed message tonight.
All right. Well, of course, that's why we had him on. In fact, we had him on last week, but he was on such a short period of time. I wanted you to get the full message because I think it is an important one. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I want to say to Don, I've read your books, Peace Child and Eternity in Their Hearts, and they had a profound impact on me as a new Christian years ago. And we've actually met one time. I don't think you'd remember, but you came and spoke at a local church here in Santa Cruz, and we were out for dinner. And I've wondered what you've been up to all these years.
Oh, right. Was it Fellowship Bible Church?
Santa Cruz Bible Church.
Yes, I remember being there. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, memories are stirring. Hey, it's good to hear from you.
Yeah.
Well, all these years since then, I've been doing just what I was doing that weekend. I'm speaking somewhere in the world 42 to 45 weekends out of every 52. And teaching about missions, and now increasingly since Secrets of the Quran has been released, I'm teaching about Islam.
Okay, fine. Do you have any other questions or comments?
The problem of Islam here in the West, Islam, as you know, is a religion of conquest, and we're in the process of being conquested, and our own government is using this for our own destruction.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't quite word it that way. Our government is allowing things which that play into the hands of Islamic strategists, but I don't know of anyone in the government, the present government especially, that wants us to be conquered by Islam. I think they're just naive.
Well, I'd say by them allowing things to go on the way they are using it, and I think there actually is a deliberate thing going on.
Okay, let's stick to what Don's message is. So what else can we do?
Probably he's familiar with the Palestinian Charter. Is that correct?
I've heard of it, but please remind me of the part of it that you are commenting on.
Well, this is basically their constitution that they wrote in 1968. It's called the Resolutions of the Palestine National Council.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, in just a few short pages, describes what they want to do, which is conquest. And when they speak of peace, I think they're only looking at the peace that they think will exist when they've accomplished their ends of suppressing the infidels, either by death, taxation, or conversion.
Yes, that's what I say in Secrets of the Quran. When a Muslim says Islam is a religion of peace, we think he means peace on mutually acceptable terms between Muslims and non-Muslims. That's not what they mean. They mean peace, yes, but only on terms laid down by Islam that fulfill the requirements of the Quran.
Sure, they have peace in a prison, they have peace in a cemetery, but that's not the peace that, of course, we would want. Okay.
The infidels, the greatest of infidels are those who proclaim the deity of Jesus Christ.
Yes.
And
Muhammad accuses Christians of being more likely than Jews, more likely than anyone else, to try to discourage Muslims from continuing to be Muslims. And I think he's right about that. At least I hope he is.
In your book, Eternity in Their Hearts, one of the most profound things I found in that book was the methodology of the missionary, which was to reach the spiritual leaders And then you found conversion through tribe after tribe after tribe across the jungle.
Yes.
Can that same sort of thing be affected with Islam?
Well, that's what I hope. Here's what I recommend, because all of us as Christians have a double responsibility. First of all, we are members of a civilization that is under attack, and we must rally to the defense of our civilization, making sure that we oppose laws that would undermine our freedoms, and try to hold the line by legal means. But on the other side, we are representatives of Jesus. We're to be loving witnesses for Him. And so we sort of balance on a tightrope between our political obligation as citizens of this nation and our spiritual obligation as representatives of the Lamb of God, who did not come to destroy men but to save them. And so in Secrets of the Quran, I've tried to give Christians information that almost all Muslims are not aware of. And once you know a certain fact in the Quran, then you have an advantage. You can ask a Muslim acquaintance a question about that verse, which is an embarrassing one, because Muhammad said ever so many things that discredited him. I mean, he kept putting his foot in his own mouth. And so if we can see where he put his foot in his mouth and draw attention to that, and you don't have to say anything accusatory, you're just innocently asking a question about something that really should be explained. Well, the Muslim may, you show him the verse where Muhammad said this, and he says, well, I don't know how to explain this, but I'll ask the mullah in the mosque. So he does that. He goes to the mosque and asks the mullah, how do you explain this verse? This Christian friend of mine drew it to my attention, and it seems to be, an awful thing, but how could Muhammad have said that? And if the mullah does not give him a satisfactory answer, then what have you succeeded in doing? You have planted a merciful seed of doubt in that dear person's mind. And then you can say, oh, by the way, I've got another question. I've been reading further in the Quran, and here's something else I found. And this way, you can sow seeds of doubt, and this is a thing you do with a desire to be merciful, because they've been brainwashed.
Well, could you come on some evening, and we could just go through some of those verses that, we could be asking our Muslim friends?
Yes.
Because most of our listeners, are not going to have the time to put the study of the Quran in that you have, but I would think I would benefit from. Well, how about you, Mike? Would you benefit from that?
I would love it.
All right, Don, would you be willing to come on some other evening?
Yes, I would. But, let me tell all our listeners, please don't think that, you can't study the Quran. You don't want to go to a bookstore and stand in line. You can bring up the Quran on your computer screen. Every single one of us can do that. If you have a personal computer, you can have access to it. Just go on to a search engine like google.com or yahoo.com. Type in Quran, K-O-R-A-N is one of the ways it's spelled, and within 3 seconds, you'll have several websites that will give you the option of scrolling through the entire Quran right on your computer screen. You can even ask for a certain chapter and a certain verse. You can even do a word study. Just say, show me every verse in the Quran that mentions the word women, or that mentions Jesus, or that mentions...
Jihad,
yes. And so you can get it. But let me give you one verse that everyone should know, which must be very embarrassing to any Muslim who knows it's in the Quran, and that is chapter 24, verse 33. Now, it's a paragraph-length verse, but right in the middle, Muhammad says, do not compel your female slaves to be prostitutes to increase your wealth. All right, sounds like he's being a moralist. Muslim men can own female slaves, yes. Other verses indicate they can have sex with female slaves in addition to their wives, yes. But at least they're ordered not to force them to be prostitutes. But wait, that statement is followed by a comma, and the comma is followed by an if clause. He said, if they care about chastity. So if a particular female slave doesn't care about chastity, her owner can force her to be a prostitute. Then it gets worse. chapter 24, verse 33 ends with this, but if you do compel them, Allah is forgiving and merciful. So there's really no prohibition at all. Muslim men, by that verse, are assured that even if they force a chaste, chastity-desiring female slave to be a prostitute against her will, God will forgive him. I mean, that's a verse to ask a Muslim about, and it'd be very hard for a mullah to explain that to any reasonable person's logic.
Well, Don, how can people get hold of your books? Certainly, Secrets of the Quran,
yes,
in Their Hearts, and Peace Child.
In Christian bookstores, you can order it on Amazon.com, and you can go, if there's no Christian bookstore near you, you can order it on my website, which is www.donrichardsonbooksales.com. And for a limited time, I'm offering this $18 hardcover book for $14.99. That's a $3 discount. Plus, when you order on the web, there's no sales tax.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much. I appreciate it. Mike, thank you for calling in. And Don, I appreciate so much your being with us. It's been a real pleasure, and I'm looking forward to having you on again.
Thank you very much, Dr.
Good night. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you out there in the listening audience have enjoyed the program and have learned something from it. I think Don is a very wise individual. He's dedicated his life to, of course, preaching the Word of God. And so we hope that many of you out there will perhaps want to even get copies of this interview with him. You may want to get his book from him. I think all of the information is available. And, of course, we certainly encourage you to do everything you can to help get the message we have out. That is, we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. And today, the very existence of our country is threatened, not only from the Muslims, but from the people who are encouraging this whole thing, because behind this whole movement is an effort to destroy Christian America. And there really are people in America in positions of leadership who hate this country. Well, please pray for America. Pray for revival, because if we don't turn back to God, God will never again bless this country. And finally, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. So until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.